Dove Creek, a novel read by the author, Paula Coomer, and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia and Leonard go about the reservation holding wellness workshops and struggle with the issue of diabetes prevention. Leonard invites Patricia and her sons to the tribe's annual root feast. We all rose from our seats in unison as a man named Horace Axtell, somber with long gray-white braids and lined amber face, stood to deliver a prayer to the Creator. He looked like an Edward S. Curtis photo, brow and lids draping, wearing beaded medallions, moving a wand of eagle feathers as he spoke. He was the leader of the Seven Drum, the longhouse religion that met on the hill behind Elise Frank's pink house just west of Lapway. More than once, Elise had invited me, but I was afraid to go. I was afraid of religious gatherings, afraid of the prophecies that revival preachers used to speak at me as a teenager, declaring that I had a special mission in life. I was still afraid of putting myself in places where I might hear it again, only escalated, cosmic demands ballooning in my absence, and the way they always zeroed in on me, the way I feared it meant work. Mr. Axtell signaled to us to sit, and the drummers took up their voices. A parade of young women began, each holding outstretched a large pot of food, walking single file to the rhythms in and around the tables again and again, until I realized they were making a figure eight. Once, twice, three times they circled. Dodie instructed me first to sip the water to cleanse my throat, and then the dishes were passed one at a time, elk, salmon, coos, camas, moss, huckleberries. Mr. Axtell blessed each. We ate in descending order. This eat in remembrance of me. Then the food came in earnest. Ham, turkey, salad, beans, corn, apples, oranges, cheese, scalloped potatoes, platters of golden fry bread. I gorged myself on the fry bread, pillowy palm-sized pieces of comfort food, accepted more salmon, took helping after helping of camas root, round sweet smoky bulbs roasted underground. The elder women teased, calling me blondie, yellow hair, ending every jab with A. Which man is yours, A? And they laughed, cackles and giggles, belly laughs. The young women came around now and again with a large orange or blue igloo jug of mountain tea, a cold clovey liquid brewed from leaves gathered in the bitter roots. This was the way it was meant to be. People were made to eat salmon and sweet moss cakes, not Big Macs, not Taco Time. We finished our feast to the drum, a louder song with a marching urge, and Dodie told me to drink the last of my water to bless what had gone before it. Brett and Zach came running with chocolate cake in the corners of their mouths. They were ready to go home. I introduced them to my home visit patients, which they tolerated, hands in pockets, then ran toward Leonard, who hailed us from the door. The women nodded, touched my skin. I walked past the food tables, which had become an irregular landscape of dirty platters and 5-gallon aluminum pots pirated of their booty, and past a huge blue Rubbermaid trash can lined with black plastic, heaped and overflowing with our paper rinds, plates, cups, bowls. A young man in a cowboy shirt and fringe suede vest, wearing a beaded headband, picked up the edges of the bag to tie it off. Leonard shook my hand and said, "Hey there, Rumi. Thanks for coming out, bringing your boys and all that good stuff." I grinned at him, leaned toward his ear, speaking softly so no one else could hear, and said, "Hey, Lautiwa, Pickatibbets, innit?" Brett and Zach have thundered out the side door of the cabin and down cranky wooden steps. a loud fight and pursuit in progress. My throat muscles harden against the loss. The moment is over. My cells are back in my body. While the boys spiral and scream their way through spring mud and patchy grass to the grizzly-sized tree lying supine near the creek, I turn back inside and try to impose camp order to the kitchen. I am Grandma Hattie, heating sad irons, the wooden ironing board padded with an old quilt, sprinkling cloth with water from an old Palmolive dish soap bottle. One iron heats while the other mashes, sizzles, and steams the wrinkles from Grandpa Darnell's cotton shirts, her calico house dresses, his filmy handkerchiefs. Her patchy linoleum over wood-planked floor is this flower-patterned floor. The dry sink and white porcelain washbowl the equivalent of this chipped porcelain sink. Hattie dips the aluminum dipper into the drinking bucket, sips the tinny water, rehangs the dipper on the hook. I turn on faucets, surrender the first few gallons to the drain, clearing stagnant pipes, cup creek-cold water to my face, drink, shiver at the defense to my esophagus, claw the plastic wrap from brawny paper towels, dry my hands while staring at the face of the handsome lumberjack, mutated from my destructive gesture, chuckle at my habit of buying these towels because I imagine being married to the strength of that picture, that face. A stroke of marketing genius. In recent years, my mother has been repeatedly telling me that my grandmother Hattie sure knew how to manage. How did women endure when the work of mere survival required the entire day? How did she teach school and rear five young children? What would she have to say about Brett and Zach and my uprooting of them, about being charged with fostering the health and wellness of an entire Indian community? I pull the foil seal from around one of the bottles of Chardonnay, twist the corkscrew to the rhythm of axes falling one after another, the sounds hitting loud, echoing late and soft, like biting hard into an apple, then sucking the juice before chewing and swallowing. I stop before the cork is out. Axes? Why the hell am I hearing the work of axes? Across the spring grass from the cabin's side door steps, standing on a downed tree near the creek, are my sons. Brett, 11 and thickish from what turned out to be hormone padding that gave way to a height of 6'2", and Zach, 8, big-boned and long, hints of the 6'5" figure he will become, his close-cropped head giving him the look of a matchstick, alternately whacking hunks of bark and cross-faded lumber. Wood chips spew like fireworks, the two so conjoined and focused they fail to notice me watching. Long enough that I give in to the steps, sit, watch the afternoon lawn shred to shadows. I decide to test my motherly will on them, tell them to give it up, put away the axes while I get soap and towel so they can clean up for supper. Wash their face, hands, and arms in the creek, which, to my surprise, they do. Devil at the Crossroads, North. September 1993. I was driving to Josie Yellowfeather's place thinking about renewing my nursing license, which was nearing its expiration date. $40 and my first time to renew in Idaho, for which the feds would pay, but for which I first had to file a purchase order, which in turn reminded me of other business such as the divorce, which was finally, thankfully, at its end. Along with the scarier parts such as signing powers of attorney to allow Mark to sell the house and vehicles. Of course, Mark got every dime of the proceeds from our possessions, mainly because I was too timid to fight him, fearing he'd wage a battle I couldn't win for Brett and Zach. I didn't know about most judges showing favoritism to mothers. I believed it when Mark said he could stand before any court and prove me crazy and incompetent. I didn't know he'd have an impossible time proving I was any other than a caring, devoted mother. I thought the hard times I'd brought on me and my children were enough to land all three of us in front of a firing squad. If I filled out what I really wanted from the purchase order, it'd be a home full of light, warmth, and responsibility. I must be horribly guilty of neglect and abuse, if I couldn't make those things materialize for my children. Lots of people tried to make me see otherwise about myself, to clue me in to the fact that I had done nothing other than run as fast as possible from a man fond of batting us around. Not that he ever laid a hand on me, other than psychologically, but how many times did I keep the kids home with bruised faces and concussions? Twice? How many times had I been called to the principal's office to explain the hand-shaped marks on Brett's throat and Zach's cheeks? And why exactly hadn't I known how to pick up a phone and dial the number? CPS? The Oregon DHW? Funnel our bodies with a change of clothes and a spew of sleeping bags into a neighborhood block home or shelter for bleeding, hysterical trailer trash types who suddenly glimpse the notion that their wounds are not commonplace? Just this morning, Leonard Wohoban had been telling me once again my point of view was all I really had to escape. Same thing I'd been hearing again and again, starting with Moose. Indian people get by in their relationships because they don't have the same ideas about connection and commitment as whites. People have 2, 3, even 4 spouses in a lifetime. Some separate but never divorce. Leonard expounded by saying the most powerful ties are stored in the blood. One family member can even kill another family member and still be welcomed home, which was the case with one of my patients who was about to lose his foot to gangrene and diabetes. Households are made up of siblings, grandparents, cousins, in-laws, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and sometimes an equal ratio of exes. Paths come together and paths part, Leonard said. You've heard of teepee creeping, isn't it? Josie Yellowfeather lived in such a situation in a HUD house with her husband, ex-daughter-in-law, and ex-mother-in-law, all given to alcohol. Josie was in her mid-50s, was confused still to be alive, didn't know what to do with her days. An explanation I'd heard from Dodie Kicking Woman and others, which was in itself a variety of death wish and suicide. I was on my way to Josie's because Ellen Barton had given her the ultimatum. Either we ship you to the hospital now, or you let the public health nurse come and check your blood sugar this afternoon. The landscape around Lapway during those months of autumn had a barren, moonlight quality about it. The walls of the earth to the north and south, which were formed by an ancient river, Lapway Creek's powerful predecessor, were spare and vegetated by a rake of wild grasses and yellow-petaled mule ears, which the summer had reduced to crackly stubble. Thunder Road, the road to Josie's, paralleled the south bank and now separated beneath the Jeep's wheels, its airborne particles becoming a dirt fog bank, and despite having the windows rolled tight and applying the air conditioner, enough dust motes filtered in to make me sneeze. Josie's driveway branched from the road, then dipped and rose at wavery with heat and suspended animation. I exited the Jeep, listened beneath my footsteps for the tremble of rattlesnakes and to the air with its short fuse. Were shoes against dehydrated dandelion enough to set Josie's acreage ablaze, the way a shout can start an avalanche? A large, Cujo-like Saint Bernard lunged and snarled against his chain in the barn loft, dripping gobby saliva from 2-inch fangs, nearly scaring the heart out of me and past which I had to walk to reach the porch. Then there was the cardboard sign nailed to the porch overhang stating in ragged magic marker script, "Trespassers shot on sight." I had to stoop to avoid clipping my forehead against it. Despite the warning, I rapped the formal-looking brass knocker again and again, trying to recall its equal on any other Lapway house. No answer, and the doorknob was locked. Around the side of the house, roughly a cord of wood was stacked under an open, screenless window. A black-haired young woman sat, eyes closed and head to chin, in a chair beside an empty half-gallon of Jack Daniels in front of a TV snowing and blaring. I yelled and tapped a knuckle on the window glass, but she failed to stir, a relief since I didn't recognize her and had no way of knowing whether she had been the one to pen the sign. Still, did I dare climb the woodpile and reach in? If I could turn off the TV and she didn't respond, at least I'd have something to put in Josie's medical record. Contact attempt, household uncooperative. And then there was Cujo. But if he broke his chain, the fall would surely kill him. Either that or he would, after all, lope across the yard to sink rabid fangs into my throat and the story would end. How long I stood there, I don't know, but Cujo continued his cacophonic coonhound bark, and I couldn't remember how that particular Stephen King novel ended, but I remember the rest of them. Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, The Stand. If there's a dog in the narrative, some human being is going to hurt, bleed, and die. After untold minutes and reckoning, at some point I held my breath, climbed atop the woodpile, reached in, and turned off the TV, feeling the slight roll and shift of the stacked firewood, which reminded me of being 16, and my brother Delbert and my daddy and I loading a rick of it into the back of our 39 Studebaker short box. A Christmas present for Daddy's boss and his wife, who'd always been so good to Daddy, with Christmas bonuses and Thanksgiving baskets. I held the image in my breath, the orange pickup and gargantuan red Christmas bow and the sign, hand-lettered, "Merry Christmas to you." They invited us in for wassail, but we didn't go. None of us knew what it was. Then, for a few seconds, all was silent as I watched the woman's chest rising and falling and counted her respirations at 18. Not one hair on her flinched. And I was back to my quandary. Did I dare climb through the window? Two cats on the sofa blinked and yawned. Black summer flies buzzed over a plate of drying food next to them. The customary laundry and sundry sacks and boxes flanked the staircase across the room. Was the sign maker up there polishing his gun? Or worse, had Josie doubled her meds accidentally, taking her morning hypoglycemic at home after Ellen had already dosed her in the clinic? Was she dead and shriveling as I stood hunkered over her windowsill about to be shot? Which was about the time the woodpile shifted. Which was about the time I noticed the smoke. Maybe it was a full moon that had a noose around everybody's neck that day, I don't know. But there it was, dissecting the east wall, a doorway leading to the back of the house from which pale smoke drifted to the living room ceiling, growing darker and darker and more abundant, but not dark or smelly enough to register with the woman or the cats who did lift their heads towards this curiosity, but whose tails barely switched once. Cujo had let up only for the brief second it took my brain to register the meaning of a black drifting mass coming from inside a house, but had just as quickly resumed, and so much louder than before that nothing could be heard beyond his barking when the woodpile crumbled in that slow motion, comedic way of things impossible, and I went belly down, eyes to roots with a knot of grass as rare in its greenness and intrusion between the driveway's concrete slabs as a snowstorm might be on such a hot, flimsy day. Wood flew, at least half the stack, releasing a whiff of summer forest, which stayed with me as I righted to half-standing and plowed the unwatered sod along the depth of the house and around the corner, then burst Starsky and Hutch style without knocking through the back door and into the kitchen's pewter-colored air, beyond ready for whatever criminal lurked and promised to take me down with his homemade version of a big city handgun.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree.
Patricia learns about human relationships and Indian attitudes toward divorce from Leonard Wahobin. She pays a visit to Josie Yellowfeather's house and is greeted by a large howling dog, a woman passed out drunk, and smoke roiling from the kitchen. But there was only the smell, an ominous, emergent smell, like the burn of turkey drippings on an oven floor sandwiched between the scent of natural gas and cast-off carbon. The blaze was brief, but horrifically bright and with its own hot, orange, breath-sucking smell. There was no time to think about consequences, merely to act. I still wonder what made me open the refrigerator to look for baking soda in this neglected home, but there it was. I stopped long enough to whiff the ages-old scent of absorbed food odors I knew would be there, emptied the entire white contents of that squat yellow box onto the raging saucepan. The contents looked like smoldered mushrooms, But that observation wouldn't stand up in court. Hallucinogens, maybe. Canned button slices, more likely. Although, what alcoholic takes time to heat mushrooms from a can? I grabbed a towel once the flames had pulsed out, threw the lot into the sink, turned on the water. The release came as a hiss of steam rising to heights far beyond what the flames had. I stood there for God knows how long, staring at the steam cloud as it grew tall enough to penetrate the dark layer of smoke sequestered by the ceiling and wall corners, trying hard not to laugh at the poor three-legged dog with its mutt-red pelt flattened to whirls and tangles, who had padded in from some unknown place, barely sniffing my pant leg before dropping his body hard against the linoleum. Through all of it, the woman in the chair in the living room hadn't emerged from her stupor, and the noise hadn't bidden anyone from upstairs with that AK-47 I imagined lashed against the massive muscle pad of a shoulder. So the only thing that made sense in terms of safety was to drive to the next house and call Eddie Dakota from BIA law enforcement. Lapway had a city cop, a career cop named Critchfield, who was always ready to back me up in town, but Thunder Road was out of his jurisdiction. Eddie never ridiculed me as some of the other officers and emergency personnel had, no matter how lame my assessments. I always called him when I was uncertain about what to do. His bearded 6'5" bulk made me feel less disconcerted. Within minutes of my phone call, Eddie's brown 20-year-old GSA sedan drove urgently in, radio antenna lashing forward, then back, then forward again as the car stopped, followed by a Nez Perce tribal prowl car driven by an officer Eddie introduced as Huey, a man of medium build and slightly longer than policy dark hair. I told them my story. We looked at the ghost on the wall where the fire's heat had blistered and lifted the paint from the plaster. I still had not found Josie, I told them. I thought she might be upstairs, but I was not willing to face a ballet of bullets to find out. Inside the house, hands on gun butts, Eddie and Huey eased their way up the staircase, their soft-footedness marked with police confidence. "Nobody up here, Patricia Fay," Eddie yelled from the top of the staircase. "Looks like somebody's got himself a nice little dope garden started up there, though," Huey said, smiling, a terracotta pot with a single short sawtooth leaf plant in the crook of each arm. Eddie walked over to the woman in the chair and laid his meaty hand on her shoulder. "Pinky! Pinky!" he said. She roused, flipped her hair, and mumbled something before falling forward on her chin and back to sleep. Meantime, Huey had wandered into the backyard, soon calling out in his clipped Nez Perce syllables, "Eddie! Patricia! I found her!" Eddie motioned me toward the door as I pointed back toward the woodpile at my abandoned nursing bag, which he sprinted over to grab and handed to me just as we reached Huey, who was standing under the whitish, hurtful sky next to a dead 50s model Chevrolet, so faded and overgrown with dried weeds it looked like a wondrous metallic fruit springing full-grown from the field. Josie sat against the dusty upholstery, gray hair plentiful and kinky amidst straighter raven black. The mass knotted behind her head, still long and uncut, indicating she had yet to suffer the loss of her closest family member. Either that or she did not observe the particular tradition. She was alert enough to call me nurse, knew the month but not the day, had no visible wounds, no lumps to the head, nothing bleeding. The acetone smell of rotting fruit wafted with her respirations. I looked away from her. Sure, I could hear the sweat trickling to the small of my back as I put stethoscope to chest and listened for heart and lung sounds, pricked her finger, inflated the cuff to take her blood pressure. Skin terse, damp, breathing shallow and rapid, pulse thready, blood pressure a tad low, blood sugar greater than 400, too high to trust the accuracy of my little handheld machine. I was undecided. What if she seized right in front of me? Had she vomited? Josie swore she hadn't been drinking, that she came out to the car to take a nap. "But across the hard weeds barefoot and in this heat?" I asked. Cujo barked nonstop. The base of his howl pounded and pounded my head like the sound of Grandpa Darnell's coonhounds chasing a raccoon or squirrel. I didn't know what else to do, so I asked Huey to radio in and have dispatch send an ambulance, even if I was uncertain of how to justify it in the record. Thunderclouds burdened the southeast horizon, the awareness of which for some reason made me conscious of the slight weight of a tiny bottle of colored glass chips pressing against my thigh from inside my khakis pocket, a newly acquired good luck charm. Even knowing I'd risk a verbal hand-slapping from Ellen Barton, considering Contract Health wouldn't pay for the ambulance ride if Josie was only drunk, I chose to follow my hunch and circumvent protocol so we could all get home on time. Eddie and I waited next to Josie, chatting while Huey radioed in, the glint of light against a lime-green Sprite bottle behind her feet finally catching my attention, but I chose to ignore it. I did not want her to be a drunk. I wanted to save her from ketoacidosis. The ambulance drivers walked over and Eddie introduced us, one red-haired and mustachioed, the other dark, Hispanic, both recognizing me from Dodie Kicking Woman's house, and another day, another time, I had called to transport an elderly man who took too many muscle relaxers before getting drunk. They suggested I learn to tell the difference between a drunk Indian and a drunk Indian. I reported Josie's symptoms while the dark-haired one leaned down to sniff the aroma on her lips, then reached under her feet for the Sprite bottle. "What's this smell like to you, Eddie?" he said. My waist suddenly felt high and narrow, a queen of hearts among four-of-a-kind jacks. "Just transport her," I said, gathering my gear to follow them to the open ambulance doors. "Money," the darker one said to Eddie. "Her blood alcohol is over 3.0. I shook my head, hugged Josie, promised to check on her. "Don't let him get to you, Patricia Fay," Eddie said as the ambulance, no siren, spun off, leaving us wincing against dust and exhaust. "But you'd better get yourself out of here. The guy who wrote that sign gets home from work any minute, and we've got a warrant coming." Eddie Dakota was the only person outside my parents and Kentucky relatives to ever address me by my middle name, and he was only privy to it because he'd fingerprinted me for my background check, and I hadn't given him permission to use it. Made me mad as a hornet, for which I cursed him as I drove away. Vashon Island, Washington is strange to the point of mythical. Coastal tribes considered it sacred and did not inhabit it. Castle-sized mounds of blackberry brambles burst with fruit under which children play fort and cowboys and Indians. And something hangs in the air, the scent of salt water, I suppose, with the sweet aroma of purple juice staining the hands and faces of children and dripping from the beaks of airborne gulls, heady, intoxicating. After 15 minutes of standing on the ferry's foredeck with that same sea air on my face, we dock, and I wait in the line of cars for the uniformed worker's arm signal telling us to disembark. The pilings are draped with heavy ropes and things nautical. The ramp looks rickety, but is, in fact, solid, and so the civic and I ascend to the paved road, consulting Vernon's penciled map. His cabin is green and tiny and sits on a mound of earth back from the street. As with the rest of the island, flora are abundant, flowers and verdant lawns, rhododendrons, lilacs, calendula, tulips, geraniums in pots and window boxes. I peruse the saddle-colored 1970s Mercedes sitting in the driveway, walk onto the cabin's small deck. "Great car," I say. He greets me with a hug and a kiss.